His brother accompanied Jesus everywhere, until Ariki was accidentally killed in China. Jesus took a lock of Ariki's hair with him, for he loved him very much. Jesus was 50 years of age when he arrived in Japan, where he married and had three daughters. Finally, he died in the Japanese village of Shingo, where he had lived for 45 years. He was buried in Shingo, which is on the main island of Japan, Honshu, and beside his tomb is another, containing the little box holding Ariki's lock of hair. Those of your fellow men who like evidence can go to Shingo, formerly known as Herai, in the district of Emori. 1. But, let's go back to our precise mission in this regard. The only messenger we could send to Earth had to be one of us. The Christ who died on the cross in Jerusalem, was called Arioch. He was brought, by us, to the desert of Judea, having volunteered to change his physical body. Thus, he abandoned his hermaphrodite body, which had lived some considerable time on Thyuba, and took on the body of Christ, created for him by our theory. By so doing, he maintained totally, the knowledge he possessed on Thyuba. Why couldn't he have remained in his body and simply reduced it in size, as Latli and Biastra did, in front of me? Couldn't he have stayed long enough in a shrunken body? There was another problem, Michelle. He had to resemble a human being from Earth in all respects, and, since we are hermaphrodites, we couldn't risk the Hebrews noticing that this messenger from God was half-female. 1. Explanation of the fascinating Emori evidence is quite long and has been published online at http://www.thyuba.com/tomb.htm. Editor's note, we can regenerate a body at will, which is why you have seen so few children on Thyuba. We can also create a body, as I have just explained, and we can reduce it in size. Don't look at me like that, Michelle. I realize that it is difficult for you to assimilate all this and to believe what I tell you, but we have already revealed enough for you to know that we are capable of mastering most natural phenomena. Jesus, who came from Thyuba, was taken by us into the desert, and you know what followed. He knew that he would come up against numerous difficulties and that he was going to be crucified. He knew all, for he had previewed his life with us, but he had done so as an astral body in a physical body. He remembered, just as you will remember and will always remember your journey to Mu and the glimpses of your previous lives. The visions, I repeat, seen by astral bodies in physical bodies are not erased in the way that visions seen by astral bodies with the higher selves are. Thus, he knew all and knew exactly what to do. Of course, he had the power to resuscitate the dead, cure the blind and the deaf, and, when he was crucified and dead, we were there to take him away and revive him. We rolled the stone from the tomb, quickly took him to our spacecraft which was positioned nearby and, there, revived him. At the right moment, he appeared again, thereby providing his immortality, showing that there was, indeed, life after death, and regenerating hope among the people by persuading them that they did belong to the Creator and that each of us possesses a spark of his divinity. So, all his miracles were performed in order to prove that what he preached was true? Yes, because the Hebrews and the Romans would never have believed him if he hadn't proven himself. There was a very good example of the strength of skepticism among people on earth regarding the Shroud of Turin. Although millions believe in the coming of Jesus and practice, more or less, Christian religions, they were anxious to hear the results of research by experts, into whether or not the Shroud covered Christ after his death. You now know the answer to this. However, people seek proof and more proof, and still more proof, for doubt still exists in their minds. Buddha, an earthling, who acquired his understanding through his own study, did not say, as your fellow men do, I believe, but rather, I know. Faith is never perfect but knowledge is. When you return to earth and tell your story, the first thing you will be asked is for evidence. If we were to give you, for example, a piece of metal which doesn't exist on earth, there would always be one, among the experts who analyze it, who would insist that you prove the metal was not created by a clever alchemist of your acquaintance, or some such thing. Will you give me something as proof? Michelle, don't disappoint me. You will have no material proof, for precisely the reasons I have just outlined, there would be no point. Faith is nothing in comparison with knowledge. But in you and when you return to Earth, you too, will be able to say I know. There is a well-known story of Doubting Thomas who wanted to touch Christ's wounds, for, seeing them with his own eyes did not convince him enough, and yet, when he touched them, he was still doubtful. He suspected some kind of magic trick. You know nothing of nature on your planet, Michelle, and, as soon as something occurs which is a little beyond your understanding, everyone claims it is magic. Levitation equals magic, invisibility equals magic, and yet we are only applying natural laws. Rather, you should say, levitation equals knowledge and invisibility equals knowledge. So, Christ was sent to Earth to preach love and spirituality. He had to contend with people who were not highly evolved, speaking to them in parables. When he tipped over the merchants' tables at the temple, angry for the first and only time, he was making a statement against money. His mission was to impart a message of love and goodness, love one another and also to enlighten the people in regard to the reincarnation of astral bodies and immortality. This was all distorted by priests in the time that followed and numerous disagreements led to the rise of the many sects which claim to follow the teachings of Christ. Christians, throughout the centuries, have even killed in the name of God. The Inquisition was a good example, and the Spanish Catholics in Mexico behaved worse than the most savage tribes, all in the name of God and Christ. Religions are a veritable curse on your planet, as I have said, and as I have proved. As for the new sects that are springing up and flourishing all over the world, they are based on control by brainwashing. It is terrifying to see young people, healthy in body and spirit, throw themselves at the feet of charlatans claiming to be gurus and great masters, when the latter are masters of only two things, talking and collecting fabulous sums of money. This, of course, gives them power and enormous pride to see themselves dominating entire crowds of people who submit to them, body and soul. Not long ago, there was even one leader who asked his followers to commit suicide, and they obeyed. Since on Earth they love proof, there is an excellent one to give them. Universal law forbids suicide. If this master had been genuine, he would have known this. In demanding this sacrifice from them, he presented the greatest proof of his ignorance. Sects and religions are a curse on Earth, and when you see that the Pope sets aside millions of francs or dollars for his travel, when he could make do with much less, and use what money is available to help countries suffering from famine, you cannot persuade me that it is the word of Christ which directs such actions. There is a passage in your Bible that says, "It is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter paradise." The Vatican is certainly the wealthiest church on your planet, and yet the priests have made vows of poverty. They have no fear of being damned, yet they believe in damnation, because they say it is the church which is rich, not them. This is really just a play on words, since they make up the church. It's like the son of a multi-billionaire claiming that he is not rich, only his father is. The church has not distorted the passage in the Bible relating to wealth. They have used it to their advantage, for isn't it preferable that the rich grow poorer at the profit of the church? The young generations on Earth are in the process of self-examination. They have come to a turning point. Events have led them to it, and I know that they feel alone, more than any younger generation has before them. It isn't by joining sects or religious groups that they are going to be free of their solitude. First, if you want to elevate yourself, you must meditate and then concentrate, which is different, although often the two are confused. You do not need to go to a special place, for the greatest and most beautiful temple of man is inside himself. There, he can enter into communication with his higher self, by concentration, asking his higher self to help him surmount his earthly, material difficulties. but certain people need to communicate with other human beings, like themselves, and they can meet together for this purpose. Those, 13, who are more experienced, will be able to give advice, but no one should ever adopt a position as master. The master came 2,000 years ago, or, rather, I should say one of the masters, but men crucified him. However, for approximately 300 of your years, the message he brought with him was followed. After that, it was distorted and now, on Earth, you have returned to a point that is worse than that of 2,000 years ago. The young generation of whom I have just spoken, are rising up on your planet and realizing, little by little, the truth of many of the things I have been talking about. But they must learn to look inside themselves for their answers. They should not wait for help to come to them from elsewhere, or they will be disappointed. Extraordinary journey meeting extraordinary people. When Thao finished speaking, I could clearly see that her aura had become dull. Outside, the rain had stopped, the sun shone on huge white clouds, tinting them blue and pink. The trees, whose branches swayed in a gentle breeze, looked refreshed and a thousand rainbows danced in the droplets of water, which clung to their leaves. The sweet songs of birds, welcoming the sun's return, blended with the soft musical sound of the insects and the light. That moment was the most magical I had yet encountered. Neither of us felt like talking and we allowed our souls to drink their fill of the beauty around us. It was the sound of laughter and happy voices that roused us from our peaceful state. Turning around, we saw Biastra, Latli and Lashnusi approaching, each flying with their own Dara. They landed just in front of the Dokos and entered without fuss, large smiles illuminating their faces. We stood up to welcome them and greetings were exchanged in the language of Thaiuba. I was still able to understand all that was said although I was unable to speak the language. This didn't seem to matter though, since I had little to say, and, in any case, if I spoke French, those who couldn't understand my words, understood my message telepathically. Once refreshed with drinks of hydromel, everyone was ready to leave again. I put my mask on and followed them all outside, where Latli approached me and attached a tari around my waist. Then, in my right hand, she placed a lituluk. I was quite excited at the thought that I was going to be able to fly like a bird. Since the first day I had landed on this planet and seen people fly by this means, I had dreamt of doing the same. But, so much was happening so quickly that, I must say, I didn't expect the opportunity to arise. Latli, I asked, why is it that you use a Tara and Lituluk to fly, when almost all of you are able to levitate? Levitation requires great concentration and quite an expenditure of energy, Michelle, even for us, and it only allows us to travel at 7 kilometers per hour. Levitation is used during certain psychic exercises, but it is a poor means of transport. These apparatus are based on the same principle as levitation insofar as they neutralize what we might call the cold magnetic force of the planet. It's the same force that you call gravity and which holds all bodies on the ground. Man, like a piece of rock, is made of matter. But, by neutralizing the cold magnetic force by raising certain high-frequency vibrations, we become weightless. Then, in order to move and direct our movement, we introduce vibrations of a different frequency. As you can see, the apparatus that accomplishes this is for us quite simple. This same principle was used by the builders of the pyramids of Mu, Atlantis and Egypt. Thao has already spoken to you of it, but now you will experience for yourself the effect of anti-gravitation. What speed can be attained with these apparatus? With this particular one, you can travel at around 300 kilometers per hour and at whatever altitude you choose, but it's time to get going, the others are waiting. Do you think I'll be able to use it properly? Of course. I will teach you how, and you must pay careful attention when you start. You could have a serious accident if you don't follow my instructions to the letter. Everyone was watching me, however it was Lashnusi who seemed most amused by my anxiety. I held my lituluk firmly in my hand, its safety strap attached to my forearm. This meant that if I let go of the lityalok, it would remain with me. My throat was dry. I must say, I was not feeling very confident, but Latli came over to me and put an arm around my waist, assuring me that she would not let go before I had familiarized myself with the apparatus. She also explained I didn't need to concern myself with the tara attached to my waist, but that the lityalok was to be held firmly. First, one had to pull quite firmly on a large button, which rendered the apparatus usable, a little like turning the ignition key in a car. A tiny light appeared indicating readiness. The lityalok was rather like a pear in shape. It was held with the base downwards, and its top ended in a mushroom-shaped hat, no doubt meant to prevent fingers from slipping. The pear was grasped around its collar. Latli explained that this lityalok had been specially made for me, since my hands were about half the size of theirs and I wouldn't have been able to use a standard model. Besides, it is important that the size of the pear be exactly suited to the hand that holds it. It was slightly soft, as though made of rubber, and filled with water. Instructions received, I gripped the lityalok so strongly that Latli had just enough time to grab hold of me before we rose into the air. We had made a leap of 3 good meters. The others were around us, stationary in the air at a height of about 2 meters from the ground, and they all burst into laughter at Latli's surprise. "Careful," Theo said to her, "Michel is a man of action. If you put an apparatus in his hand, he will use it immediately. If you press the lityalok as you just did, with a general, even pressure, you will rise vertically. If the pressure is slightly greater with your fingers, you will go left, with your thumb, you will go right. If you want to go down, either release the pressure or, to descend more quickly, you can press on the base with your left hand." As she spoke, Latli had me practice the movements and we had climbed to an altitude of about 50 meters when we heard Thao's voice. "Well done, Michel. You should let him do it alone now, Latli. He has the idea." I would have liked her to keep her thoughts to herself. I didn't share her opinion at all and I felt much more confident under the protective wing of Latli, and I mean no play on words. She did release me, however, but remained close by and at the same height. Gently, I released my grip on the lityalok and ceased climbing. Releasing the pressure further, I began to descend. Reassured, I pressed evenly around the collar and shot upwards like an arrow, so far, that my fingers froze and I continued to rise. "Relax your hand, Michel. Relax your hand," shouted Latli, who, in the wink of an eye, had joined me. "Oh." I stopped, or almost, at approximately 200 meters altitude, over the ocean, for I had inadvertently pressed more strongly on my frozen thumb. The others joined us at our 200-meter-high rendezvous. I must have been wearing a strange expression on my face, for even Lashansi burst into laughter, and that was the first time I had seen him do that. "Gently, Michel. This apparatus is very sensitive to touch. I think we can go on our way now. We'll show you the way." They moved off slowly, Latli remaining by my side. We maintained the same altitude. By pressing with the palm of my hand, I advanced smoothly and soon noticed that I was able to accelerate at will, merely by regulating this pressure on the lityalok. Finger pressure regulated height and direction. I still made some unexpected swerves, especially when my attention was distracted by 3 imposing characters who crossed our path. In passing, they threw me a glance, obviously quite astonished at the sight of me. After a time I judged to be about half an hour, I began to master the machine, at least enough to fly successfully over the ocean. With no obstacles to negotiate, we gradually picked up speed and I was even able to fly in formation beside my companions without straying too often. It was so exhilarating, I could never have imagined such a sensation. Because the equipment created a kind of force field around me, making me weightless, there was no sensation of being suspended, as there is in a balloon, nor was there the sensation of being carried by wings. Further, being completely surrounded by the force field, I couldn't even feel wind whipping at my face. I had the impression of being an integral part of the environment, and the more I exercised control over the apparatus, the more pleasure I gained from this new means of locomotion. I wanted to test my control and, so, descended slightly, only to climb again. This I did several times, choosing to gain or lose altitude on the others. Finally, I moved nearer to Thaw and telepathically communicated my euphoria, letting her in on my intention of skimming the ocean that stretched, below us, as far as the eye could see. She agreed and the whole group followed me at water level. It was absolutely fantastic to be able to skim over the crests of the waves at a speed of approximately 100 kilometers per hour, as if we were all powerful gods, conquerors of gravity. From time to time, silvery flashes indicated that we were flying over schools of fish. In my excitement, I was not aware of time, but it seemed that the voyage lasted 3 classes. No matter which way I turned my head, I saw only the line of the horizon. Then, suddenly, Thaw telepathized, "Look over there, Michelle." Far away, on the surface of the water, I was able to make out a speck that grew rapidly to reveal itself as a mountainous island of reasonable size. We could soon make out enormous rocks, bluish-black in color, which plunged sharply into the blue-green waters of the ocean. By increasing altitude, we gained a bird's-eye view of the whole island. There was no beach to be seen, the enormous black rocks prohibiting access from the ocean. The waves crashing into the base of their imposing masses were iridescent under the sun's rays, reflecting shimmering colors which contrasted with the uniform black of the basalt. Halfway up the slopes which faced inland, grew forests of gigantic trees, their foliage strangely dark blue and gold, their trunks blood red. These trees covered steep inclines right to the edge of an emerald green lake. In places, the surface of the lake was obscured by wisps of golden mist. In the middle of the lake, as though floating on the water, we could make out an enormous dogo, its point upwards. I later learned its diameter was about 560 meters. Its exceptional size was not its only peculiarity, however, its color was another. All the dokos I had seen to date on Thaw Uba were of a whitish color, even those at the City of the Nine Dokos. This one, though, seemed to be made of pure gold. There it was, shining in the sun and, in spite of its very ordinary egg shape, its color and size rendered it majestic. Something else surprised me greatly: there was no reflection of the doko in the waters of the lake. My companions led me towards the dome of the gold dogo. We flew slowly, at water level and, from this perspective, it was even more impressive. Unlike other dokos, this one had no point of reference to indicate an entrance. I followed Thaw and Latley, who soon disappeared inside. The other two were at my side, each having caught hold of me under an arm so that I wouldn't fall into the water, for, in my surprise, I had let go of my Lituluk. I was literally stunned by what I saw. Here is what I discovered inside the dogo: I could see about 200 people floating in the air with no help from any apparatus. The bodies seemed to be asleep or in deep meditation. The one closest to us floated about 6 meters above the water, for inside the dogo, there was no floor. The bottom section of the egg was actually in the water. As I have already explained, once inside a dogo you can see outside, as though there were nothing between you and the world outside. So, in this case, I had a panoramic view of the lake, the hills and the forest in the background and, near me in the middle of this landscape, floated 200 or so bodies. It was completely astonishing, as you would expect. My companions were watching me in silence and, unlike other times when my wonder had made them laugh, they remained serious. Looking more closely at the bodies, I began to notice they were generally smaller than my hosts and some had quite extraordinary, and sometimes monstrous, forms. "What are they doing? Are they meditating?" I whispered to Thaw, who was at my side. "Take your Lituluk, Michelle. It's hanging on your arm." I obeyed, and she then answered my questions. "They are dead. These are corpses. Dead? Since when? Did they all die together? Was there an accident? Some of them have been here for thousands of years, and the most recent, I believe, has been here for 60 years. I think that one, in your current state of surprise, you are not going to be able to operate your Litialik effectively. Latli and I will guide you. 1. Religious pictures and sculptures depict crucifixion by means of nailing through palms of hands to the cross. According to human anatomy, however, soft tissues between the bones in hands are not strong enough to support the weight of the body on a cross. Nails would simply slip between fingers. In contrast, nails through human wrists are wedged between bones and provide much stronger support. Editor's note: each of them took hold of me under an arm and we began to wander among the bodies. Without exception, they were entirely naked. Among others, I saw a man sitting in the lotus position. His hair was long and of a red-blonde color. He would have been 2 meters tall when standing. He had golden skin and his features were remarkably fine for a man, and he was, indeed, a man rather than a hermaphrodite. A little further away lay a woman, whose skin was coarse like that of a snake, or the bark of a tree. She appeared to be young, although her strange aspect made it difficult to judge her age. Her skin was orange-colored and her short, curly hair was green. Most surprising, though, were her breasts. They were quite large, but each one had 2 nipples, separated from each other by about 10 centimeters. She would have been close to 180 centimeters in height. Her thighs were thin and muscular, and her calves quite short. On each foot were 3 enormous toes, but her hands were exactly like ours. We passed from one to another, sometimes stopping, sometimes moving on, as one does among wax figures in a museum. The eyes and mouths of all these people were closed, and they all occupied one of 2 positions, either sitting in the lotus position, or lying on their backs with their arms by their sides. "Where do they come from?" I whispered. "Various planets." We spent some time before the body of man, apparently in the prime of his life. He had bright chestnut hair that was long and curly. His hands and feet were like mine. His skin was of a familiar complexion, that of someone from Earth. In height, he would have been around 180 centimeters. His face was smooth, with noble features, and there was a soft goatee on his chin. I turned to Thau, whose eyes were fixed on mine. "One would say that he came from Earth," I said. "In one sense he did, but in another, he didn't. You know him well by having heard him spoken of." Intrigued, I examined his face more closely, until, telepathically, Thau said, "Look at his hands and feet, as well as his side." Thau and Latli brought me closer to the body, and I could clearly see scars on his feet and his wrists, one, as well as a gash, approximately 20 centimeters long, in his side. "What happened to him?" "He was crucified, Michel. This is the body of Christ of whom we spoke this morning." Fortunately, my hosts had anticipated my reactions and supported me under the arms, for I am convinced that I'd have been unable to maneuver my Litialik. There I was, staring at the body of Christ, worshipped and spoken of by so many on earth. The man who had been the subject of so much controversy and so much research during the past 2,000 years. I reached out to touch the body, but was prevented from doing so by my companions, who drew me away. "Your name is not Thomas. Why must you touch him?" "Is the doubt in your mind?" said Thau. "You see, you confirm what I was saying this morning, you seek proof." I felt terribly ashamed for having initiated my gesture, and Thau understood my regret. "I know, Michel, that it was instinctive, and I understand it. In any case, you can't touch these bodies, no one can, apart from one of the 7 Thauri. In fact, it is the Thauri who install these bodies in a state of preservation and levitation, as you see them, and they alone are capable of doing so. These are the actual bodies they had during their lives?" "Of course. But how are they preserved? How many of them are there and why?" "Do you remember me telling you, when we took you from your planet, that there were questions you would ask to which we would give no answers. I explained then that you would learn with us all you needed to know, but that certain things would remain a mystery because you must not document certain points.